On the program tonight, an exclusive interview with David Long. To mark the release of his autobiography, the former Prime Minister granted just one interview, so we dedicate the whole half hour to this giant of New Zealand politics. G'day everyone, haere mai, welcome to the show. It's Monday the 8th of August. Tonight, David Longhi, an interview to celebrate his story of his life. David Longhi became Prime Minister in 1984. The 6 years that followed have been exhaustively documented by others. The clash of personalities, of egos, of ideologies. In short, a jubilant honeymoon became a tense marriage and an acrimonious divorce. And the man whose presence cast itself over much of a tumultuous decade, well, he's now 63, in hospital and terribly unwell. Today, though, the publication of his memoir, simply entitled My Life. My life has been widely reported as a kind of settling of political scores, but in fact it's far more generous, human, and more domestic than that. Much of it is about his very New Zealand childhood, which somehow seems much more distant now than it really is. David Longhi was one of four children. Here they are, the Longhi family, that's little David there on the trike. He didn't stay little for long. By secondary school, he was not only physically big, he was finding the bigness of language and wit that would save him as an adolescent and define him as a politician. He was a prefect at Otahuhu College. His speaking skills were already exceptional. He became a lawyer, then a politician, then, of course, Prime Minister. And as his father's son, he struggled to balance his sense of what a Labour government should be with his colleague's sense of what that particular Labour government could be. David Longhi entered politics confident he could change the world. Well, he did, although neither he nor his government would survive the experience intact. If he's diminished now in health and size, his intellect and spirit endure. We spoke to him just before he went into hospital, and tonight we devote our entire program to that interview. David Longhi, My Life. We begin in Auckland in the 1940s in the company of the boy and his mother.
Well, she was quite unique. I mean, she was really quite something. She was formidably active. She was a one-person charity and her own bicycle. Mm-hmm. She fed kids and grabbed kids and looked after kids. And in later years, of course, she would have been under risk from the Labour Department for harbouring overstays, because our house was always full of people from the Pacific or from Asia.
Particularly on Sundays.
Yes. It was just on the lawn, and they were there and put the mats out, and we'd have all these people from the Pacific.
And she'd cook lunch for them all?
Oh, yes. I still have people come to New Zealand and say hello, and I struggle, and then I remember who they are, and they're the ones that I knew.
And your dad was the GP in this community, and would often work for free because of the sorts of people he was working with.
He did. He had a funny approach to money. He was not moved by it. He was a strange contradiction, my father. He had the best house in Otahuhu. And yet he was the most careful of spenders. And he was not profligate. And he did things for people for nothing. In fact, he got into trouble with the BMA years ago when they introduced the Social Security payment of 7 and 6 pence for seeing a patient. My father used to give them 2 and 6 back for coming to see him because he was still 5 shillings up on the deal. The BMA said that was unprofessional conduct. But that was what he was like. And I... absorbed an awful lot from him. He was a very compassionate person. He was not... One of the great disappointments of my life was I went back and did my master's degree and got a good degree.
You got a first-class honours. You're too shy to say that.
And then he died before it was awarded.
I want to talk about an incident that had a great impact on your life and your father's life and was, I guess, responsible for you becoming a lawyer. Certainly it seems that way in the book. And that was, your dad was charged with indecent assault following a gynecological examination at an evening clinic. And he was found not guilty. And the judge in the case later
who, in fact, his lawyer later became a judge. Yes, that's right. And you saw him as a yeah. young lawyer, and he said, "I want you to know that your dad was not guilty."
Yes, that was two remarkable periods of my life, both connected with the same thing. I mean, this I can't convey even today. And in fact, when I was writing it, I had tears running down my face because I remembered my father being taken away and put in the cells and locked up in Mount Eden.
Because there was
four nights in Mount Eden, cells during the day. Dreadful, really. And then I was waiting in the big hall outside the Supreme Court.
The jury was out for less than an hour.
It was out for a very short time.
Yeah, yeah.
And he came out, and I remember grabbing him and crying my head off. And the next time I was with my father in that court, I was being admitted as a lawyer. Later, after he died, I was representing someone in a murder charge, and the judge called us into chambers and said, "Long, I'd like to speak to you." And he told the Crown Prosecutor to get out of it, sort of thing. That's when Lester Mole, I said what he said. And it was the second time I was sort of overcome in the precincts of the Supreme Court.
So he told you that... I think, what did he say? He said
sometimes people who are found not guilty are guilty, as you know, but your father was not guilty. Yeah.
And that experience was truly formative in obvious ways, but also it made you think about becoming a lawyer, didn't it?
Well, I was set on being a lawyer then. I was set on it for a while, and then I was sort of messed up a bit because when I came to the end of my sixth form years, my father had heart trouble in 1959 in my last year at school. And he explained to me that he wouldn't... He didn't have any cash reserves, really. And he said, "Sorry, but I'd have to get myself through university." And then I couldn't see how I could. So I applied for studentship, which is one way of getting it, be a teacher and do a degree and then move to law after that. But I did get a job at the freezing works, and that liberated me. And I got more out of that than I did out of any studentship. And I was able to go straight into law.
It seems you have a degree of ambivalence towards some of what you achieved as a lawyer. There's a beautiful story of you phoning your dad to tell him that you'd gotten someone off on a sort of piece of reasonably Socratic defence by you. And what was his response?
Disgusting. No, that's true. You see, you've got a problem. You've got a... I had a lot of success in the law without any justification. I had people... I had to plead with some of my clients not to give evidence because they knew if they did, they'd convict themselves. But if I tested the evidence, I'd get off. I've had policemen have to take 44 dozen bottles of beer from the fourth floor of the Magistrates Court back to premises in Ponsonby where they took them from on a charge of sly grogging because they had come to the court with their own bottles of beer. And I then said, "And whereabouts is the certificate of analysis?" And they hadn't got them analysed.
So they had the beer. Yeah. It was clearly there in the bottles.
Yeah, unopened.
Unopened. But you were able to say, "How do you know it's beer?"
That's right. You haven't got it. Beer is defined in the State of Liquor Act as liquor which on analysis is found to contain more than 2% proof spirit.
So on the one hand, this is entirely admirable. If you look at it in terms of being a defence lawyer, you were bloody good. But on the other hand, your dad's point rather holds.
Yes, it is. I mean, and the difficulty is that when you win them, you feel a considerable regret sometimes. I did worry about people I won. I won a case once involving a man, minor assault charge, and a month later he was up on the murder charge. And you worry about that. And I got to the end where point where I couldn't stand anymore. Particularly under the Police Offences Act, it was just, I couldn't cope with it. I got revolted. Now, you can't justify a lifetime of doing that.
Is why you don't do the honourable and the consistent thing and pull out of the ANZUS alliance, for whether you are snuggling up to the bomb or living in the peaceful shadow of the bomb, New Zealand benefits, sir, and that's the question with which we charge you, and that's the question with which we would like an answer, sir.
And I'm going to give it to you if you hold your breath just for a moment. I could smell the uranium on it as you lean towards the door.
Obviously, you were impressed by eloquence in other people, and you obviously had registered it. When did you understand that you had the ability to have an impact with what you said?
Well, it was when I was asked to do impromptu speaking at in my intermediate school. But I was also encouraged before that in the church. You see, Methodism was a very distinctive form of religious organization when I was young. It was sort of the Labour Party at prayer. And they had a great deal of strength in their advocacy. The oratory of some Methodist preachers was renowned. And then I went to London, and the great Methodist trio of the Second World War, who all preached within a mile of each other around the centre of London, were still going and still preaching, and it was just amazing. Not a note, none of the three used a note, and yet none talked rubbish. They were all constructed, thoughtful, sequential sermons. And it was really inspiring to me then.
What was inspiring, the subject matter or the
manner
of...
Well, it could be done, the manner of doing it, and the fact that the difference between those people who get notes, become absolutely the victim of their notes, are terrified if they miss a line, and if they shift a page, would collapse. And those people who know their subject and are confident enough to be able to articulate what they're thinking about without a single note. I mean, that's what I did. I was, from the very start, an impromptu speaker. Every important speech I made was impromptu. My maiden speech in Parliament. But the Oxford speech was two-thirds scripted and one-third impromptu.
And the impromptu bit was?
The impromptu bit was the best bit.
The bit that everyone remembers.
Yes.
He was a particularly sort of intense and earnest little fellow, that guy who asked you that question, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he needed that.
And when he asked you the question, in the fashion that he asked you it, was it like a sort of a kind of bingo moment?
It was a godsend.
Was it? Do you remember exactly what you said?
Yes, I'll come back to you in a moment. Don't rush. Don't lean forward, I think. I can smell the uranium on your breath.
You said at intermediate school that you wanted to be Prime Minister and you thought you'd be Prime Minister. You told Bob and Maud Wynyard you would be Prime Minister. I think you said
told them where it would be done.
Yeah. You said you were going to be Prime Minister in 84, right?
Yeah, and in Christchurch Town Hall.
And this was when you were watching Rolling. Were you watching Rolling in 75?
Yep.
Yeah.
While I was watching him in 75.
How did you know? And I mean, you knew to the day, really, didn't you? How did you know?
I didn't know, but that was my hope. There's something that should be said about that, John, too. That I was at that stage at the start of a period which can eventually destroy you if you're not careful. At the start of a period where you had to know everything, you had to predict everything, and that you had to fall on your feet by most of those things happening. And I did very well out of that. I think part of the success was my sheer size to begin with. I was obvious and I was comfortable. I made a professional career out of appearing to be on top of things. And it has a huge toll, because the risk is that you become persuaded that it's true. I thought I was bulletproof, that I could sort of get away with things. I thought it was... I thought that I would be able to claim knowledge of some things but weren't really sure of what it was about. I had to give the appearance of the roller coaster not having gone off the tracks. And part of that drift into self-delusion, if I could say so, can be taken back to those days in 75 when I was looking forward at the possibility of doing these things. And I mean, you can be too self-critical, because after all, there is a great worth in aiming high and working for a cause. But it must have seemed absurd to them that I said that.
Behind me, we have a Prime Minister.
When you became Prime Minister in 84, and I have the passage somewhere, and I'd like to read it back to you, but it possibly is better that you recall it yourself, that sense of elation on election night. And I think you used the word elation twice.
It's hard to convey. It was just so magnificent. It was. There are a few things in life which cause you to be in ecstasy. One of them for me is jumping off a reef in a tropical atoll with no one around and just diving deep and seeing the coral and then coming out and the tang of the water and the sheer exhilaration of being alone with the universe and in this environment. That night in the Metro Hall was one of those nights. I was gone beyond my bounds of normality in terms of the way in which I felt things. This was something unbelievable, and I was happy.
If you look back on it now, what do you make of it? And your own behaviour, would you have done anything differently?
I hope so. Go back to the period, though. Let's call it from 84 to 90. New Zealand changed. It became its own being. The New Zealanders started to assert themselves in their own right. It was no longer good enough to be assumed to be the toy of Britain or of anyone. The idea of going where Britain stands, we stands now is to tell that to the people on the streets of Taranaki. We just don't do that anymore. We had over those 6 years a revolution in the way in which we managed the economy. And that was a subject of considerable damage to us politically and myself personally. But I have never resolved from the fact that we had a crisis to contend with. We had to do things, and you can now buy a ticket, a $10 Australian note, without having to buy a ticket to Sydney.
I want to end on the book itself. What's it been like writing it?
Oh, it was a long haul. Started a long time ago, and I've enjoyed it. I've gone through periods of great sadness, as I remember parts of it, and people that I wrote about, and very difficult to write about some of the occasions and the splits. And you can't actually freeze your feelings about people based on one performance over a period of 6 years. So there's unfairness in the book in that regard, because some have come out badly who have been good. But I ended up being respectful more than ever of Helen Clark in terms of handling a MMP situation which was out of control without falling for any suggestion that she does it through charm. And I have renewed my respect for Michael Cullen, who was always sound in cabinet.
I want to interrupt you. So you're respectful of Helen Clark. You've renewed your respect for Michael Callan. What about your attitude towards David Longhi, as you've written this book? What do you make of him now?
Well, the nice thing is that what do I make of him now?
What do you make of yourself, looked back on?
I was a good Prime Minister. If you talk about the score for the balance, was it a plus or a minus? It was a plus. Let's be clear about it. An opportunistic piece of prime ministership. I wouldn't have been any sort of prime minister if it hadn't been for the financial crisis, you know, when we came into office. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been any sort of prime minister. I wouldn't have won the prime ministership if it hadn't been for Muldoon. Mm. So, I mean, you can't claim greatness in any of those things. But keeping the balls in the air for the time that I did against the background of the tennis court having become completely overgrown and snakes hiding in the grass was quite an achievement. But today, you don't have to make anything of me. I'm quite happy that you find me as I am, in my total mobility taxi, in my wheelchair, in my slippers, and in the joy of my home with a wife who has been absolutely devoted to me. And who's smart too. It's a bit of a problem, that. And she's clever. And a daughter who's just great. So I love it here. How much longer, I don't know, but it's a nice place to be. Thank you.
It's been nice being here with you, David Long.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah.
David Longhi, former Labour MP and Prime Minister, now, of course, author, husband and dad. That's the show for this evening. Thanks heaps for watching, everyone. Ka kite. Good night.